Support for this segment provided by Freak Out and Carry On, a new podcast about politics through the lens of history. Hosted by journalist Ron Suskind and historian Heather Cox Richardson. Available wherever you get podcasts and on the WBUR Listen app. Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. You're confident when it comes to your work and life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same confidence when it comes to refinancing your existing mortgage or buying a home. It lets you understand all the details so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, the deepening White House crisis over Russia. Also at that meeting with the Russian lawyer, a Russian spy. Donald Trump Jr., to say the least, is uneasy.
In retrospect, I probably would have done things a little differently. Again, this is before the Russia mania. This is before they were building it up in the press. For me, this was opposition research.
Senators grill President Trump's choice for FBI director. Christopher Wray promises independence.
No one asked me for any kind of loyalty oath at any point during this process, and I sure as heck didn't offer one.
And the health care fight goes on in the Senate. More protests on Capitol Hill. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Margaret Taleb of Bloomberg News, David Drucker of the Washington Examiner, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. What do you make of Donald Trump Jr.'s emails? Do you see collusion, treason, a witch hunt? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington, Margaret Taleb, senior White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Margaret, welcome back to the show.
Hi, John. It's great to be here.
And also, we've got David Drucker, the senior political correspondent for the Washington Examiner. David, thanks for being with us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, John, Margaret, and David.
Guys, let me start with the question of Donald Trump's emails and what is plain and what is not plain from those emails. We heard some people coming out and saying that there was evidence of, one, collusion, two, treason, and other people saying, no crime here. Anybody would have taken this meeting. David Drucker, let me start with you. Would anybody in a political campaign, according to those that you've covered, have taken that meeting?
No. I can't think of anybody that I've covered that would have taken that meeting, I guess, except for the president of the United States and his 2016 campaign. Look, we've all covered political campaigns for a long time. Opposition research is a part of, frankly, trying to win campaigns. You look into your opponent's background. It's a painstaking process. It's actually, in a sense, an art form. The opposition research consultants and strategists that do this for a living. And they do this for a living. They have their own firms. They work for political committees. They look far and wide in places people would never think of. They travel to obscure courthouses and cities hall all over the globe sometimes, looking for documents that can put their opponents in a compromising position and cost them votes. So that's the business of politics. But there's not a situation that I can think of, and I don't think it's true at all, that if you're approached by a foreign government or who you believe to be a foreign government, and this representative says, we want your candidate to win and we have information for you, that they're going to take the meeting and try and use it. And look, we've already heard Republicans talk about the 2000 presidential campaign when the Bush campaign got a hold of a Gore briefing book somehow, and they didn't use it. They called the authorities and turned it over. So this is – opposition research is peddled, and when it is, people listen, but it depends on who it's coming from, and there's usually a high bar for where it's coming from anyway. Who is this person? What is their agenda? Because you don't want to be made to look like a fool if you start running with something that turns out not to be true or in and of itself is compromised.
Margaret, let me play a clip from Donald Trump Jr. Discussing this meeting with Sean Hannity on Fox, and we'll get you to react on the other side.
For me, this was opposition research. They had something, you know, maybe concrete evidence to all the stories I'd been hearing about, but they were probably underreported for, you know, years, not just during the campaign. So I think I wanted to hear it out. But really, it went nowhere, and it was apparent that that wasn't what the meeting was actually about.
Margaret, let me ask you, one, does it matter that he claims the meeting went nowhere? And two, is it apparent from what we know that the meeting was not about that? We've learned this just this morning that a Russian spy also attended that meeting.
Yeah, that's right. We're getting a lot more information. This is very much an evolving story. But I think one thing that's important to point out is that, you know, Donald Trump Jr.'s response and the White House's response in general has been to say, so what, the meeting happened, that doesn't, you know, that just nothing happened. As the president said, it was like zero happened. But the revelation that is important is that the meeting happened and that he believed at the time that he was going to be getting some information about Hillary Clinton that could be damaging. Up until now, up until this week, the narrative, the storyline from the White House and the campaign and the transition before then was that this was just a made-up story. There was nobody had any contacts with Russians. The whole thing was just like not true. And there are a lot of questions about the content of this meeting, the premise of this meeting. That's fine. But the fact that it happened and that the White House and the president's family had not been forthcoming about it up until now is important. And it's important not just because of Donald Trump Jr., who doesn't have a formal role in the White House. It's important because of questions about what the president knew. He says he only knew about this a couple days ago. People will prod at that. And it's important because of the role that Jared Kushner played. Jared, of course, the president's son-in-law, a senior person in the campaign, but also now a senior advisor inside the White House with major portfolios stretching across foreign policy and the economy.
Now, we heard from one of the counterparts of Donald Trump and Mike Pence in the campaign last year. That was Tim Kaine, the senator from Virginia. Jack Beatty, I'm going to play his assessment of what he learned this week and get you to react after that.
This question of collusion, which essentially starts to transition this into potentially a treason investigation, when he was approached with this idea, he should have turned it over to law enforcement immediately. That's what anybody should have done.
Jack Beatty, does treason sound like the appropriate investigation to you, or is that going too far?
It doesn't sound appropriate. That's hyperbole. I mean, you read what the experts say. Treason refers to giving aid and comfort to the enemy in a time of war. We're not at war. Russia isn't an enemy in that respect. Treason doesn't fit it. It's bad enough. We don't need the inflation. And, you know, what I'm struck with here is how Mr. Trump seemed to have himself colluded in coming up with a fake story for his son flying back from Europe on Saturday. He approved the initial White House statement that essentially was a lie about what went on at this meeting. He was involved in that, and you know, you just look at father and son here, and you wonder, right and wrong just don't seem to exist in that family. It's all about win or lose. The first time anybody getting a call from somebody connected to the Russian government, knowing that, would say, wait a minute, this is going too far. We can't possibly talk to you. This is, and you put it in an email, even if it's wrong, it could be detected. Sorry. Instead, this young man said, I love it. And you have to wonder, were there other connections? There was a, behind this woman who came to him, behind the whole story, is a whole group in Russia whom Trump has had to do with, an entertainer, his father, a prosecutor in Moscow who, you know, was involved in in fraud cases. So there's a big backstory here, And I think it's going to come out drip by drip. And whether it reveals direct contact, more contact with the Trump campaign, we don't know. But, you know, I think a former Watergate prosecutor had it right this week. This wasn't hyperbole. She says this wasn't a smoking gun. It was a smoking cannon.
All right. Let's bring one of our listeners into the discussion right now. We've got Peter on the line from Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. Peter, welcome to On Point. We got the best reporters in the business on the line, so you go ahead and hit them up.
Yes, Mr. Harwood. The Democrats have destroyed Trump's presidency, and they are now determined to destroy his son. Charles Schumer, Adam Schiff, Bernie Sanders, Dianne Feinstein, Michael Bloomberg, and especially George Soros, and other evil Jewish communists are determined to destroy Trump.
Oh, okay. I think we're going to stop you right there, Peter. That's way, way over the line. David, the strong feelings that caller represented are an element of the American political debate. What is your assessment of how Donald Trump's supporters have reacted to the news as it is dribbled out?
Yeah, well, as a Jewish reporter, I'm still looking for my check for my control of the media. Let me get that out of the way right there. Look, I understand that there are many of Trump's voters, supporters, and just Republicans on the right in general that are suspicious of the press and believe that the press has generally been easier on Democrats than Republicans. And over the years, I think there's some justification for their disappointment with coverage. I will say, though, that the coverage that I think that President Trump is getting is been largely on point, no pun intended, because so much of it is driven by his tweets and what he chooses to focus on. His base remains loyal. The Republicans that I've talked to out in the country that are not members of Trump's base but are Republican voters are sticking with him because given their choices, they'd rather have Trump in a Republican Congress than Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And so they don't necessarily like the tweeting or the behavior, but they like Trump's agenda and they'd like to see him get it accomplished. And I don't think his presidency has been destroyed in part because we're so tribal in our politics these days. And he still has a chance to do health care reform and tax reform. He got a Supreme Court justice appointed. He's undone a lot of Obama's regulations that were passed during the Obama era. So there's a lot left to do, and it's all up to Trump how he wants this to turn out in large part.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. With Rocket Mortgage, you can apply simply and understand fully so you can mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about another wild week in the news. You can join the conversation. What do you think of FBI Director nominee Christopher Wray? What's your message for the Senate, for your senator, on health care? My guests this hour are Margaret Taleb of Bloomberg News, David Drucker of The Washington Examiner, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. I want to start this segment, guys, by playing a defense that President Trump offered of his son, Don Jr., while he was in Paris this week.
I have a son who is a great young man. He's a fine person. He took a meeting with a lawyer from Russia. It lasted for a very short period, and nothing came of the meeting. And I think it's a meeting that most people in politics probably would have taken.
Now, Jack Beatty, I noticed that you called Donald Trump Jr. a young man, like the president did. At this stage in my life, I share your perspective on that, but I wonder whether or not other people calling him a kid, a young man, whether that serves to diminish the sense of responsibility for what he did. And also, I wonder whether it is credible to you, and I'll ask Margaret to chime in after you, that he would not have told his father about this meeting that involved the campaign chairman and Jared Kushner.
Well, John, you're absolutely right about the mischief of using the phrase young man, and I'd merely said it as an old man. A 39-year-old should know right from wrong, should know Russia from America. And it is not credible to me, and I can't believe it's credible to anybody who's not terminally naive. It's not credible to believe that he didn't mention this to his father in some fashion or other, or that Manafort, who was there, didn't mention it, or that Jared Kushner didn't mention it, or that Goldstone, the fellow that was, you know, the agent who sent this information and also was connected to his father, he didn't mention it to his father. It's hard to believe that none of those people told him. And so we're going to find out more about that, and ultimately, Mr. Trump may well have to testify under oath about that. And of course, given his propensity to lie, that is going to be a perilous moment for him.
Margaret, Kellyanne Conway was on a television program today and said that all of this stuff didn't amount to much because we were promised, she said, sustained, continued, furtive collusion. What is she talking about, and what is actually happening with the White House revised statements about what was wrong or what might not be wrong?
I don't think there's a kind of collusion that's okay. That's okay, right? I mean, so the—
Did you promise proof of sustained, furtive, and continued collusion?
The president's position and the White House's position has been, and I'll paraphrase different top aides, quotes, you know, intermingled in here, nothing burger, zero, nothing, no collusion, fake news. So the White House's lineup until now has been that there just wasn't, you know, contact about this, that none of it was true, and the emails show otherwise. And so the question now becomes something different, and it's a question— As this entire story has been from the beginning, there are two tracks of this. There is the political track and there is the investigative track. There are multiple investigations of the Russia matter going on, multiple FBI probes into Russian interference, Russian manipulation of the media, and then, of course, the links there were between the president's campaign and the Russians, whether any of those links crossed the line. So all of those, and then the special counsel's probe right now as well. So that is separate from the political track. And your other question about what the president's son told him or told other people is certainly going to be, you know, probed by all of these investigations. But it comes down to a matter of discretion, because a decision about whether or not to bring a candidate into the loop on all of the offers that are being made to the campaign is a question of discretion, as is the very question of whether to meet with someone who reaches out for a meeting. And so,
Margaret, having covered this president and understanding the way that Donald Trump operated the campaign, do you personally think it is credible that a meeting in which the campaign chair, the president's son-in-law, and the president's son attended of this kind and magnitude would not have been mentioned to the president?
I think that discretion has not been a hallmark of the campaign, and that it's not credible that nobody outside of the three people in that room ever knew about it.
David, what do you think?
Well, it's in some ways it's hard to tell, right? Because campaigns that we have generally covered have been so structured, even campaigns that I have seen that have appeared to be undisciplined and been sort of riven with mistakes, have run in a much more professional way than this one did. And yet, of course, this campaign was a winning campaign. Normally, the way these things work is you have campaign aides, no matter how senior, take a lot of meetings and look into a lot of things and keep the principal, the candidate, out of it, because you want the candidate to at least have plausible deniability if things aren't worth their while or problematic. Then you bring them in if you determine that they need to be involved. So it's theoretically possible that Paul Manafort, who is understanding of how a professional campaign should run, and it's one of the reasons they brought him in during that period where they needed to make sure they won delegates and operated at some sort of organizational level, thought that this wasn't something that the candidate shouldn't be involved in. On the other hand, it was a small, close-knit group, and President Trump, then Candidate Trump, regularly let everybody know how closely involved he was, to the point where he was, you know, picking out stage designs for the Republican National Committee's nominating convention, and, you know, how involved he was in everything else. And given how close he appears to be with members of his family that were involved and how important they were. I mean, this was not just the president's son trying to, you know, wiggle his way into the campaign to be important. I mean, Donald Trump Jr., Eric Trump, and Ivanka Trump were gatekeepers, were some of his most important trusted advisors. So the idea that they wouldn't speak with their father about any meeting, no matter how inconsequential, it's possible, but it's I don't think it's something we can accept on its face, given how this campaign operated.
And I think it's possible, but it's likely possible if there was a decision made not to talk about it. Does that make sense? So there are other people who it seems likely might have been consulted about something like this, right? And I don't want to speak to what happened because we don't know what happened. But just thinking this through, you know, Michael Flynn, was he brought into the discussions? Jeff Sessions, was he brought into the discussions about this? And if not,
very good point.
If the only three people who knew about it were in fact these three people, why did Paul Manafort say we should never discuss this? This never happened. We should never talk about it. Or what would be the reason for them to be the only three people to know?
All right,
that's a very good point that Margaret brings up, given how the campaign operated.
We're going to consult one of our callers. We've got Carol on the line from Metairie, Louisiana. Carol, welcome to On Point. What's your question?
It's not a question. It's more of a statement. From New Orleans, Louisiana, Metairie is a suburb. Are there a lot of Republicans here who think that this is still not a legitimate president? I mean, Secretary Clinton is a well-known commodity. There's nothing about the Clintons that people in this country don't know. And for Paul Manafort to be considered as a party of their naive, this is bizarre. And for you all to call it, the only entity that seems to have won in this election is Russia. Russia seems to have won themselves a president, but the people of the United States are not certain that this is a legitimate president because of all this online voting. We need to revolt this voting and go back to a paper ballot where you can have a one-person, one-vote count so we can know we have a legitimate presidential election. I mean, I think it is treason. I think somebody needs to walk the plank. Because, I mean, we don't have a viable government right now. This is bizarre. Thank you.
Carol, thanks so much for your call. Jack Beatty, Sebastian Gorka, one of the staffers in the Trump White House, was on television today saying the Trump administration is considering returning the properties that were seized by the Obama administration in response to the hacking as a sanction. Saying that we want to give a chance at collaboration with Russia. Is Carol right that Russia, in fact, is the winner in this situation?
Well, you can argue that Russia has come out ahead, although reporting from Moscow says that the Russians don't feel that way. But look at some of the evidence. Look at the State Department. The initial human rights report that it came out with, I think, very early in the term, Secretary Tillerson didn't even announce it. And, of course, usually that is done by the secretary. And, of course, it had things in it criticizing Russia. He did later make a strong statement on this, but he's got nobody else around in that State Department. There are, scores of appointments that haven't been made. France doesn't even yet have an ambassador. Of all the departments the Russians don't like, it's state, because state raises human rights questions.
And Margaret, as you know, it took quite a while for President Trump to affirm the United States commitment to NATO's Article 5, which is something that was very important to our allies.
Yeah, to explicate it and to underscore it. But, you know, when I talk to my colleagues in Moscow, Bloomberg reporting team, what they talk about is Russia's frustration that things have become sort of so toxic that, what does Russia want? Russia wants these sanctions to go away. Congress is not going to sign off on these sanctions going away. In fact, they're prodding things in the opposite direction. So did Russia get some things that they wanted out of this 2-hour and 15-minute meeting with President Trump? Yeah, I would say so. Does Russia think, at the very least, that the situation's gone too far to be terribly beneficial for them in terms of some of their immediate goals? Yeah, I think so.
All right. I want to not neglect another important story this week, which is that Christopher Wray, who was the president's choice to lead the FBI after he fired James Comey, testified in his confirmation process before the Senate this week. And he got a lot of tough questions about whether he would stand up to interference from the administration. Here's how he responded to that question.
If I am given the honor of leading this agency, I will never allow the FBI's work to be driven by anything other than the facts, the law, and the impartial pursuit of justice, period, full stop.
David Drucker, do senators believe Christopher Wray on that point? And do they also believe that the president, in response, if he is independent, would not fire Christopher Wray or fire Bob Mueller, for that matter, who's leading the special counsel investigation?
Well, I don't know that there's a lot of trust in the idea that the president would never fire Bob Mueller, the special counsel, and would never intervene again and fire an FBI director. But I think we do know that Christopher Wray was very well received by most senators on both sides of the aisle. Mark Warner, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, has already announced that he's going to vote to confirm Christopher Wray when he comes up for a vote on the House floor, Senate floor, for confirmation. And I think that actually you can look at how well received Christopher Wray was, how prepared he looked for the job, and everything he had to say about the special counsel's investigation and his view of the FBI's role in the executive branch and in law enforcement. And wonder how much better firing James Comey might have gone for Trump had it been handled differently, had he been able to quickly announce that he was making a change to somebody like Christopher Wray and not been, you know, off the reservation as he usually is in talking about, you know, firing Comey because he was unhappy with the Russia investigation. I mean, the whole firing was bungled.
David, what would be the reaction if President Trump fired Bob Mueller?
I don't think he can afford to fire Bob Mueller because it would look like he's trying to kill an investigation that's going somewhere, even though at this point we don't know that the investigation will ever dig up anything that's that devastating.
Jack, do you agree with David? There have been a lot of predictions about lines the president's couldn't cross without a toxic reaction that he's crossed anyway.
One just doesn't know. It all depends upon the Republicans. And I'm heartened by some signs that there's some resistance to the excesses of the administration. Senator Grassley, we're going to have hearings next week with Don Jr. testifying. The Senator Burr with the Intelligence Committee has seemed to me to be pretty straight. Ben Sasse of Nebraska. So there are people there who are not just party line. John McCain, who aren't just going to go along with anything, and firing Mr. Mueller would be, you know, Saturday Night Massacre revisited, and it would just simply blow this whole thing up. And I think a critical mass of Republicans, I would hope so, would just say this is enough, and we're going to talk about impeachment proceedings.
Margaret, as we see an accelerating pace of disclosures about, you know, Jared Kushner revises his form. We have more and more information coming out, the White House conceding more and more ground. Do we have any idea under the sun when we're going to find out what Bob Mueller knows or whether he's going to decide that he has enough to make a report?
Any prediction is only as good as the information up until the time the information changes. And I just can't emphasize how fundamentally important the revelations about this meeting and Don Jr.'s emails may be in terms of expanding the course of this investigation and as a result, perhaps changing the timeline. I think there was some early thought, particularly after Jim Comey's sort of second round of testimony, some early optimism inside the White House that this could be wrapped up, you know, by the fall, that it was important to give Bob Mueller some political space, the perception of space and non-interference, so that he could do his job, let him do a credible job, finish up asking around, and it would turn out that, sure enough, it was totally fine for President Trump to let go of the FBI director. This would all be over. The revelations of the past few days have changed a lot of Republican lawmakers' thinking about whether they actually understood everything that had happened, and may change the scope of the investigation now.
Do you expect as a reporter that we're still going to be covering next July the forthcoming Bob Mueller report?
I don't know, but the Republicans standing up for re-election in the midterms, I think, hope that that will not be the case.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, the Antarctic Peninsula just got smaller. A hunk of ice the size of Delaware broke off.
In Antarctica, a titanic shift in our planet's landscape. A massive iceberg, one of the largest in recorded history, has broken away from an ice shelf known as Larsen C.
Rip current swept away a family enjoying the beach in Panama City. Beachgoers, over 80 of them, formed a human chain to save them. 8-year-old Stephen Ursay was rescued with his family.
We got caught in the current, and, well, our mom had to go in after me and my brother, and the people made a human chain and pulled us out.
And the king of YouTube has been dethroned. For about 5 years, Gangnam Style was the most viewed video ever on YouTube. Now, Wiz Khalifa's See You Again has taken over the top spot.
How can we not talk about family when family's all that we got? Everything I went through, you were standing there by my side. And now you're going to be with me for the last ride.
And you can join our ride. What are you thinking this week on net neutrality, gene therapy, the smaller Antarctic shelf? My guests this hour are Margaret Talev of Bloomberg News, David Drucker of the Washington Examiner, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Margaret, before I move on to another topic, I just want to get to one question about what's happening inside the White House. We know that the meeting that came out this week in the Donald Trump Jr. emails had been part of a revised filing for a security clearance that Jared Kushner made. So people are trying to draw conclusions about who is backstabbing whom, and what are the dynamics inside? Could you talk about what you've learned about whether we're seeing intense, as the legal heat rises, factionalism within the White House? And if so, who's on what side?
John, I have to say that since January 21st, there have been some indications of factionalism. So it's hard to tell how much of this has changed and how much of this is a constant. But I think there are two things to look for. One is this sort of battle that we have long known about between kind of the nationalist populist camp inside the Trump White House and more of the globalist camp, which Kushner is a part of. And that's still there. But another is the question about Trump's family being able to continue serving in advisory roles. And I guess the third is a question about legal exposure
That's what I was wondering about, whether we're seeing evidence that some members of the inner circle are taking steps that we're seeing reflected in the media to protect themselves legally at the expense of other people.
It's possible to protect yourself legally without doing it at the expense of other people. And it's called getting a lawyer and being careful about what you talk about and what conversations you participate in. And I think that this is not something that everybody just thought about 4 days ago. This is something that has been a concern since since Comey's firing and to be honest, since Mike Flynn's firing. And so I think what you're seeing is a natural progression, probably kind of a stepping up of some of those concerns. And, you know, for some of the staffers inside the Trump White House, they're independently wealthy and you know, getting a lawyer is not a big deal, but for some folks, this can be a very actually expensive kind of concern or pursuit to have to take care of, as well as something that's really nerve-wracking if you get into government to serve because you care about public service or because you believe in a candidate and you want to help them execute their vision. This is not, none of this is anything that that folks sign up for. And so I think this is stressful for a lot of people inside the White House.
No doubt about it. Expensive emotionally as well as financially. All right, let's shift topics a little bit because we do have the United States Senate considering reorganizing 1/6 of the American economy. Hasn't been the biggest story of the week, but it's still pretty big. And we had President Trump in an interview with Pat Robertson, the former presidential candidate and broadcaster on the Christian Broadcast Network, giving an assessment of how he sees the situation and what happens if they fail.
I will be very angry about it, and a lot of people will be very upset. But I'm sitting waiting for that bill to come to my desk. I hope that they do it. They've been promising it for years.
David Drucker, two things struck me about that statement. One is, he seems to be separating himself from the consideration of the legislation when he talks about they've been promising it for years. And the second, he says he'll be very angry if it fails, but it's not obvious to me anyway, and you tell me if you see it differently, that he is mounting a large public pressure campaign beyond some tweets to get it passed.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I think in part when he says they've been promising it for years, it's because he wasn't a part of the they for years. He came over to repeal and replace late in the campaign, has been a longtime supporter of universal health care run by the government. And as he became more of a Republican to run for president, saw the value with the Republican base of supporting the repeal and replace of Obamacare. So I can understand that part. When I talk to Republicans on Capitol Hill, and I have been doing this for months, they have felt that the president, on the one hand, was way too involved in trying to browbeat and strong-arm members privately into voting for just anything without providing some real policy parameters to try and keep the legislating headed in a positive direction, and not using really at all the power that he does have or could have, which is with Republican voters in states where you have wavering senators or members of the House during that process, to create political cover or political momentum to get these tough votes done. You know, there are certain states where the president could go in and create political momentum so that members worried about voting for a bill that has very low approval ratings and you don't know how it's going to go. As Democrats discovered, they all meant well with Obamacare. It didn't work out so well for them politically. He could create political momentum with his popularity with the base. And then there are other states where he could create political pressure because of his popularity with Republicans. And, you know, a lot has been said about the bill not being popular and not necessarily being the best piece of policy. But there is a lot of pressure on the right to fulfill this promise and to fix a healthcare system that is in need of fixing. And the president has been absent. And I think a great comparison here, John, and you'll remember this, was how President Obama 8 years ago, every time it looked like Obamacare was about to go off the rails, the Affordable Care Act, the president was there publicly to keep things moving. So as important as Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid were to keeping the gears going in Congress, the president's work with the public in command of detail was very helpful to them. When I talk to Democrats now and they remember that process, how important the president was. And this is the whole reason you have a president. And I think that President Trump here is missing an opportunity to try and help this thing along.
Jack Beatty, David rightly notes that there's a base, Republican base, that wants him to do this, even if some members of that base might be adversely affected in terms of their health care. But he also mentioned the poll ratings for this bill, which are pretty low. He said he's going to be angry if it doesn't pass. Isn't he going to make a good chunk of people angry if it does pass?
Yes, whatever happens, there's going to be harm for him and his party. And that may be why he's distancing himself already. You know, they have promised. He promised, too. He promised during the campaign repeatedly a better system that would cover everybody. He promised in May.
I'm quoting him, pre-existing conditions are in the bill. I mandate it. They are gone from the bill now. That's what this Ted Cruz, option, let insurance companies come up with a bare bones plan if they offer a full plan, which will, of course, create what the insurance industry itself calls a kind of death spiral as all the sick people go into one plan and all the young people go into another. But the point is, pre-existing conditions are gone. The president, the promise he made in May, the bill would break in July.
Now, the president has been trying, and Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, has been trying to push this bill forward, and McConnell adjusted it over the 4th of July recess. But he hasn't impressed everybody with the changes that he's made. In fact, we're seeing some pretty strong public statements from critics on both the left and the right. Here's Rand Paul after he got the outline of the new bill.
No, I think it's worse. I mean, the old version repealed most of the Obamacare taxes. This repeals about half the Obamacare taxes.
Margaret Taleb, how is this bill different? And is it, in fact, from a conservative point of view, worse than the original bill?
Well, from that tax posture, where it dials back less of the tax increases on the wealthy, you can argue it's worse, but it does give a lot of flexibility for states both to dial back, and maybe some of the states don't want this, the Medicaid, and also to kind of create more of a split to kind of decouple, people with pre-existing conditions and other folks. So fundamentally, it hasn't resolved the question of whether Republicans want to use the legislation to better protect people who need health care coverage or to reduce costs. And when you're trying to bring both sides together, this is like kind of the balancing act, but it's hard to protect more people and save money. It's actually expensive to cover people. That's the whole reason why Obamacare was unpopular. People want the coverage, so they just don't want to pay for it. And so you have the capacity to lose two votes. They've lost two votes. The question now is, do they lose a third? And there are many ways they could lose that third. Is it Shelley Moore Capito? Is it Rob Portman? You know, is it Dean Heller? Is this whole array of Republicans that are considered moderate Republicans now in today's kind of parlance, never mind the conservatives. The McConnell's hope has been that in the end, you can kind of pull a rabbit out of the hat, that they can afford to lose the two that they've lost and everyone else can be brought on board. That's not clear at this point.
Let's go to one of our callers. We've got Stephanie on the line from Santa Fe, New Mexico. Stephanie, welcome to On Point. What's your question?
Hi, John. I have a comment, and that is that I am just flabbergasted that we've come to a point with our Congress where just to make a point that they can pass legislation, they will pass legislation that 75% of Americans don't want. And I would just really like to see our Congress stand up on its hind legs, work together, and make health care possible for this country. I just can't believe it's so immature.
If you say hind legs, does that mean you think Congress is some kind of an animal?
What?
You said hind legs. Does that imply that Congress is some kind of an animal?
I mean, I want them to stand up and represent the people what they have been.
Yes, that's what she's saying.
Stephanie, thanks so much for your call. David Drucker, give me a bottom line here. Are they going to pass this bill?
So I keep sort of getting back to this idea that they'll find a way to pass it and pass something. And here's why I tend to think that. Number one, Republicans now own the healthcare problem in America, and although people differ on who is to blame for the healthcare problem, the healthcare system does need to be fixed. And so Republicans can either, as the caller would prefer, work with Democrats, maintain Obamacare but fix it, strengthen it, and repair what's wrong, or they can work with themselves and pass some sort of partial repeal of Obamacare to fulfill a promise they have been making for 7-8 years. Of which, if they fail to do, their base and even Republicans beyond the base are going to be very unhappy, and they're going to say to themselves, "We gave you control of all three branches of government, or the two that are involved in legislating, and you did nothing with it. So why should we bother showing up in 2018? Because you guys are useless." So when you combine the policy issues of needing of healthcare needing fixing and the political issues of maybe the greatest promise in political American political history, I just think that they're going to find a way to get this done, as bleak as it looks. And just because the ramifications of failing to do so basically means they can't govern. And if anybody thinks that, great, let's move on to tax reform, that's so much easier, they're fooling themselves.
David, does that
mean the whole thing
could
come tumbling down?
Does that mean the idea that Mitch McConnell and some other Republicans have talked about dropping back to a fix bill is not viable?
I just don't know that it's politically viable for Republicans to take repeal off the table, even though this is only a partial repeal. And that's the condition that Democrats have. And, of course, the minute Republicans would drop down to that level, Democrats would smell blood and they'd say, like we said, repeal is off the table, but sure, we'll work with you. And that would just be a whole world of political hurt for Republicans. Look, 8 years ago, Democrats, although they made a better attempt at bipartisanship than Republicans are doing this time, whether it was for show or whether it was real, ended up having to work with themselves. The public rejected it, and Republicans won a couple of hundred seats in two midterm elections because of it. And now Republicans are in the same sort of position. And they unlike Democrats, they know what's coming if this doesn't work.
Right. Jack Beatty, before we go, President Trump was in France this week. He noted that many people don't realize that France was one of our earliest allies, a pretty significant fact in history, I would say. But we're also at the 100th anniversary of when the Doughboys came in World War I and made a big difference. You've got a personal connection to that story. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Well, my dad was one of them. And, you know, when you look at the America of 100 years ago and today, I'm struck with the similarity. Just as Woodrow Wilson, the professor in office, was sending the troops over, something was building in the country, and that was a reaction on the part of the country and the small town against the city. The census of 1920 was the first time that cities were the majority. And cities were where the economic prosperity was. And cities were where the progressivism was. And the rest of the country in the 20s, beginning with Prohibition, reacted against that. We're in that same cycle again. The country and the town against the city. Donald Trump embodies that.
Margaret Taleb, senior White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Thanks so much for spending an hour with us.
Thanks, John.
And David Drucker, senior political correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Thank you, too.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.
And as always, on point news analyst Jack Beatty. Have a good weekend, Jack.
Thank you, John.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up on Monday, the Senate unveils its revised health care bill. We'll unpack what's in it and where it goes from here. Tom is back. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.